Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, June 26th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin with world stories. After 12 days of Israel-US-Iran war, what has changed? Starkly different narratives about the Israel-Iran war's results point to multiple unresolved issues and underlying tensions that remain. A central question is whether post-war diplomacy, if and when it resumes, returns to square one. By Scott Peterson, Shoshana Solomon, and Taylor Luck, reporting from London, Tel Aviv, Israel, and Amman, Jordan. Within hours of the end of the 12-day war that Israel launched against Iran, which included unprecedented U.S. strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, all sides raced to declare victory with blustery bombast. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Tuesday that Israel had achieved a historic victory, which will stand for generations. Israel had removed two existential threats, he said, of annihilation by nuclear weapons and by 20,000 ballistic missiles. President Trump said the one night of American strikes, quote, totally obliterated Iran's nuclear program and set it back for decades, not just months, as initial intelligence reports suggested. The first ever combat use of 30,000-pound bunker buster munitions ended the war, he said, comparing them to the atomic bombs dropped by the United States on Japan to conclude World War II. And Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who hid in a bunker throughout the conflict, on Thursday issued a video saying Iran's victory had delivered a heavy slap to the face of America. The U.S. intervened only to prevent Israel's annihilation, he asserted, and he ridiculed Mr. Trump's demand that Iran surrender, saying it will never happen. The well-practiced propagandists of the Islamic Republic even created a Lego-style victory video which portrayed Iran's missiles as sending Israelis running for their lives into rat-infested shelters before striking their strategic targets and melting a plastic Israeli flag with flames. The starkly different narratives about the war's results point to several unresolved issues and underlying tensions that remain. They also suggest mismatched expectations that are likely to influence future decisions about Iran's nuclear program and security across the Middle East. Indeed, analysts say that while the shooting may be stopping for now, the conflict is far from over. If so, what has changed? Whither diplomacy now? Among key uncertainties is the fate of Iran's stockpile of 400 kilograms, 880 pounds, of uranium enriched to 60% purity, a short technical step from weapons grade, which Iran says it successfully moved before it was attacked. The war began June 13th when Israel launched its first wave of 200 fighter aircraft in a surprise attack that targeted Iran's nuclear facilities, its ballistic missiles arsenal, and its top military and nuclear science leadership. After staying on the sidelines for a week, Mr. Trump joined the campaign before dawn Sunday, ordering American B-2 stealth bombers to target Iran's hardened nuclear sites with 14 bunker buster bombs and a host of cruise missiles. A central question is whether post-war diplomacy, if and when it resumes, returns to square one with Iran insisting it has a right to enrich uranium on its soil, and the U.S. and Israel insisting it does not. It's unlikely that the U.S. will feel it necessary to soften its position, says Ali Vaez, director of the Iran program at the International Crisis Group. So the question falls to the Iranian side to accept a compromise or double down with a weaker hand. Iran is crowing about the unprecedented damage it inflicted by penetrating Israeli air defenses with an estimated 10 to 15% of nearly 600 missiles it launched, according to Israel's Institute for National Security Studies, INSS, leaving 50 impact sites in urban Tel Aviv and elsewhere looking like Gaza rubble. Iran's vulnerabilities revealed, but Iran also revealed its own defensive vulnerabilities and intelligence failures, says Mr. Vaez. Israel immediately seized control of Iran's skies, struck with impunity, and operated agents on the ground in Iran. In addition, the damage to Iran's nuclear sites and expertise may not be a terminal blow, but it's undoubtedly a major setback in terms of capacity, says Mr. Vaez. There are some within the ruling system who will argue that a nuclear deterrent is now essential, but whether they can marry capacity and intent remains to be seen. Removing such a bomb option was the Israeli and American goal. Israel has said it will respond forcefully to any violation of the ceasefire that Mr. Trump announced Monday, and Mr. Trump has said the U.S. can strike again. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, achieved what it could have achieved, says Chuck Frelick, a former Israeli Deputy National Security Advisor, now at the INSS in Tel Aviv. We severely downgraded the Iranian nuclear program. Maybe we didn't eliminate it, but we bought time, and that's what it's always been about with the Iranian nuclear program, gaining time. INSS figures indicate Israel attacked more than 1,480 targets in Iran and killed 606 Iranians, including the assassinations of more than 30 top military officials and 15 nuclear scientists. The IDF says it destroyed more than 300 missile launchers, which it estimated to be 75% of all those in Iran. Losses inside Israel include 29 killed and more than 3,500 injured. Israel's campaign helped it regain its deterrence factor toward its enemies, says Daniel Viner, an international relations expert at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. It is not only about deterrence and legitimacy, but also about political influence, says Dr. Viner. Admiration about how courageously, quickly, intelligently, and surgically Israel conducted the war may change some element of how global public opinion looks at Israel. Iranian rethink expected. Israel's strikes will require a long process of rehabilitation, says Israel Ziv, a retired IDF general. The Iranians will need to internalize the fact that, even as they perceived themselves a superpower and tried to convince the world that they were such, in the end it was a paper tiger, says General Ziv. We can expect them to rethink their ways, he says. If they will revert to being belligerent, they will have to again face Israel and the U.S. Adds Mr. Vaez, noting the weakening before the war of Iran's axis of resistance allies from Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon to the Houthis in Yemen. For the Islamic Republic's strategists, the question should not just be about the 12 days of war, but the setbacks across more than 12 months to a national security doctrine that's built up over decades. Still, there are few signs so far that Iran will recalibrate its positions, despite withstanding the heaviest direct military pummeling since the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. Iran was outgunned and outsmarted, and they simply know that this is not a war they can win, says Hamid Reza Azizi, an Iran expert at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin. Yet, while Israel delivered significant blows, Iran also preserved its capacity to retaliate, he says. Noting that in the final days of the war, Iran achieved qualitative escalation by launching fewer missiles, but with a higher percentage that successfully evaded Israeli air defenses. And though most of Iran's enrichment capacity has been damaged beyond repair, the fate of Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium may determine Iran's next steps, Dr. Azizi says. The Israeli stated goal was to deprive Iran of the ability to build a bomb, he says. If Iran opts for nuclear ambiguity, then this war might have had the reverse effect. Arab states' diplomacy undermined. The war has reverberated far beyond its belligerents. Arab states view the Israeli war on Iran as dragging the region back toward polarization and conflict and undermining the Arab-led push for cooperation and prosperity that Mr. Trump endorsed on his recent visit to the Gulf. Israel reinvested in the use of hard power when everyone is trying to create links between different countries, says Mohammed Baharoun, Director General of Behuth, a public policy think tank based in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. People will start thinking, is this idea of having connectivity, a space for us to coexist without having to fight, still possible? Even should the Israel-Iran ceasefire hold and Arab-led diplomacy continue, the conflict has dramatically changed Arab states' views. The conflict hit home that diplomacy alone cannot guarantee Gulf security, says one Arab diplomat from the Gulf, asking not to be further identified. From Ukraine to Gaza to the Iran war, we are learning that might makes right, he says. We will not abandon the rules-based order Israel and the West are undermining, but we cannot count on it to protect us. Next story. Iran relies on China and Russia. They didn't show up for its fight with Israel. Much has been made of the emerging alliance among China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, but the recent strikes on Iran highlight its limits. By Ann Scott Tyson and Fred Weir, reporting from Beijing and Moscow. In mid-June, as Israel waged a military blitz against Iran, Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin held an urgent phone call. Tehran, a key provider of drones and other military support for Russia's war against Ukraine, and a vital source of oil to fuel China's economy, was in a bad spot. Israeli attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and the looming potential for strikes by the United States risked engulfing the Middle East in a broader war. The current situation is highly perilous, Mr. Xi said. Mr. Putin agreed. Yet, while the Chinese and Russian leaders called for a ceasefire and de-escalation, and later voiced strong condemnation of the U.S. bombing of Iran, overall, they have stayed on the sidelines of the Iran-Israel war. Iran's weakening at the hands of Israel's military has highlighted the limits of its alliance with China and Russia. The three allied countries, together with North Korea, have all significantly bolstered their ties in recent years, leading some Western experts to dub them an authoritarian axis of upheaval. Iran is taking a significant amount of hitting, but Russia and China have not stepped forward to beef up its defense, says Nader Habibi, professor of practice in the economics of the Middle East at Brandeis University's Crown Center for Middle East Studies. In terms of effective military support for Iran, they have both been reluctant. More broadly, the reactions by Beijing and Moscow underscore the priority both are placing on advancing narrower national interests and avoiding entanglement in a Middle East conflict, experts say. Neither Russia nor China seem especially interested in sticking their necks out for Iran, says Rosemary Kalanick, director of the Middle East Program at Defense Priorities, a Washington think tank that advocates military restraint. I'm sure Iran has noticed that. Bringing Iran into the fold. China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, sometimes collectively referred to as CRINK, are united ideologically by a shared desire to challenge and eventually replace the U.S.-led international order, which they view as disintegrating. Right now, there are changes, the likes of which we haven't seen for 100 years. And we are the ones driving these changes together, Mr. Xi told Mr. Putin as he departed the Kremlin in March 2023. China and Russia have significantly deepened ties, personified by the close relationship between Messrs. Xi and Putin, since the two leaders signed a sweeping Sino-Russian no-limits strategic partnership in February 2022, just weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine. That invasion, in turn, has seen Russia strengthen economic and military cooperation with China, Iran, and North Korea, both out of necessity to bolster its Ukraine war effort and as part of a broader campaign against the U.S. and its allies. Iran has sold Russia thousands of drones, as well as bombs, missiles, and other military hardware for use in Ukraine, which indirectly allows Tehran to test its munitions. Iran also transferred technology for unmanned aerial vehicles to Russia, which now produces them locally. In return, Russia has supplied Iran with warplanes and captured Western military hardware. Meanwhile, Iran has been allowed to join two multilateral organizations spearheaded by China and Russia. Last year, it gained entry to BRICS, an economic bloc founded in 2009 that now has 11 member countries. And in 2023, Iran joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, a Eurasian security group started in 2001. Indeed, on Thursday, China hosted the defense ministers of Iran and Russia in the eastern coastal city of Qingdao at the SCO defense chiefs meeting. Russia and China have been very active in developing a Eurasian bloc, and they have gradually brought Iran into that bloc, says Dr. Habibi. Transactional relationships. Then, in January 2025, Iran and Russia signed a 20-year strategic partnership treaty, While it does not contain a mutual defense clause, the pact calls for Iran and Russia to cooperate against common military threats, share military technology, and conduct joint exercises, which they do annually with China. Yet, despite Iran's entry into such accords, including a strategic partnership concluded with China in 2021, Tehran could not count on Beijing or Moscow to go beyond rhetorical support in its clash with Israel and the U.S. Ultimately, these are transactional relationships, says Dr. Kalanick. Iran, as the smaller, weaker, more isolated, and less wealthy junior partner, must accept whatever help China and Russia are willing to provide. The latest strikes give Moscow significant leverage over Tehran, says Alexei Mukin, head of the Independent Center for Political Information, a consultancy in Moscow. The Iranians are clearly very frightened, says Mr. Mukin, speaking after the meeting between Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and Mr. Putin in Moscow on Monday. Mr. Putin told Mr. Araghchi that Russia would provide support to the Iranian people without making any military or economic commitments. Iran needs friends right now, and only Russia and China are in any position to help, says Mr. Mukin. Balancing national interests. While Russia is preoccupied with the Ukraine war, China's priority vis-a-vis Iran is to safeguard its investments in the Middle East and access to Iranian oil. China buys an estimated 90% of Iranian oil exports, an amount that represents an economic lifeline for Tehran, while it constitutes only about one-tenth of China's oil imports. Given its powerful economic interests in the region, Beijing has stressed that it seeks stability in the Middle East through a lasting and effective ceasefire. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Guo Jiakun said on Wednesday. Beijing and Moscow both seek to keep the current Iranian regime in power and may see opportunities in helping Tehran rebuild its nuclear program and defensive capabilities. Yet, as major powers, China and Russia are likely to temper their involvement with Iran, lest it impact their relations with Israel and the U.S., experts say. Now is an excellent opportunity to end the conflict, Sun Degang, director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai, was quoted as saying in the China state-run newspaper Global Times, Israel, Iran, and the U.S. have all achieved their goals in the conflict, and Washington can now claim credit for facilitating the Israel-Iran ceasefire, Dr. Sun said. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story, 10 years after same-sex marriage ruling, these conservatives aim to roll it back. It's been a decade since the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed a right to same-sex marriage. Public acceptance has grown since then, but some conservatives aim to challenge that ruling in an echo of what happened with Roe v. Wade. By Simon Montlake. Brian Kamenker is used to being on the losing side of the same-sex marriage debate. He fought unsuccessfully for years to reverse his home state, Massachusetts, decision in 2004 to legalize same-sex marriages, the first state in the union to do so. He grew even more determined after the Supreme Court's Obergefell versus Hodges decision in June 2015 established a federal right to marry, a ruling that Mr. Kamenker calls fundamentally flawed. Mr. Kamenker's organization, Mass Resistance, is among a constellation of conservative, mostly evangelical groups that is laying the groundwork for a long-shot legal push to try to get the Supreme Court to roll back Obergefell. They argue that the social and legal pressure to accept same-sex marriages is undermining religious liberty and the traditional family, and that states should reclaim authority to regulate such unions, just as they now do for abortion. Simply put, Obergefell, in their eyes, was a mistake, and what the Supreme Court giveth, it can take away. All you have to do is persuade 5 of the 9 judges, says Mr. Kamenker. Rolling back same-sex marriage rights is not something that the Republican Party at large, or President Donald Trump, particularly wants to take on. Public opinion, party leadership, votes in Congress, and legal scholarship all suggest that opponents of same-sex marriage face a severe uphill battle. Even before the Obergefell ruling, polling showed a majority of Americans supported the right of same-sex couples to marry, and a surge in same-sex marriages since then appears to have boosted public approval and reinforced a view in Washington that what was once a powerful wedge issue now has mainstream acceptance. To many who defend same-sex marriage, opposition by people like Mr. Kamenker appears rooted in bigotry. Some watchdog organizations label Mass Resistance a hate group. Mr. Kamenker and his allies say their movement is based on traditions tethered to biology, society's reliance on marriage as a support for child-rearing and natural law, plus, for many, proscriptions in the Bible. When marriage is redefined, fatherhood and motherhood are deemed optional, and it is children who suffer, Arthur Shaper, field director for Mass Resistance, told a North Dakota state legislative committee in February. Earlier this month, the Southern Baptists passed a resolution at an annual convention held in Dallas to oppose Obergefell and other laws that defy God's design for a marriage and family. Backers of the resolution are aware of the uphill nature of their battle. The non-binding resolution is an effort to keep the conversation alive. Its author, Andrew Walker, a Baptist from Kentucky, told the New York Times. In 2022, Congress voted to codify same-sex marriages in a bill that passed with bipartisan support. The Respect for Marriage Act replaced the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which had defined marriage as between one man and one woman. Similar language was officially removed just last year from the Republican Party platform, which had previously castigated Obergefell as robbing Americans of their legitimate constitutional authority to define marriage as heterosexual. But opponents see a new opening, fueled by anti-woke politics on the right and a broader rejection among independents and even some Democrats of new left-wing orthodoxy on gender and identity. Beneath the surface of public acceptance of same-sex marriage, they believe, lie a widening partisan divide and a conservative reaction against society's leftward shift on LGBTQ+ rights and gender roles, which could be mobilized in a campaign against Obergefell. And the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision in 2022, overturning a national right to abortion that had held for 5 decades, showed that the most dogged climbers sometimes do eventually reach the summit. There is a sense of at least some momentum on the far right for trying to gut those marriage protections, says Melissa Deckman, chief executive of the Public Religion Research Institute. Ms. Deckman says PRRI's polling shows that while there's broad support for same-sex marriage, there has been a collapse of support among young Republicans in recent years. In 2020, about 64% of Republicans between the ages of 18 and 29 supported marriage equality, compared with 83% of Democrats. In 2024, Democrats' views were almost unchanged, but only 51% of Republicans approved. Young men were more likely to disapprove than young women. Similarly, a Harvard Youth poll that surveyed more than 2,000 Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 in March 2025 found a sharp partisan divide. 52% of Republican respondents said same-sex marriage was morally wrong, compared with 11% of Democrats, according to Gallup. There is a 47-point gap between Republicans and Democrats on approval of marriage equality, the highest since it began tracking this measure in 1996. Gallup found that Republican support in 2025 had fallen to 41%, down from a 55% peak in 2022, but still above the 30% level in July 2015. Seeking change at the state level first. Since the 2015 Obergefell ruling, the Supreme Court has moved to the right, a shift that President Trump engineered in his first term when he appointed three conservative justices. Those justices later delivered the reversal of Roe v. Wade that Mr. Trump had promised to evangelicals and other social conservatives who voted for him in 2016. In a concurrent opinion for the Dobbs ruling, Judge Clarence Thomas wrote that Obergefell could be overturned on similar grounds as Roe, since a right to marry is neither in the Constitution nor deeply rooted in U.S. history. Those seeking to overturn Obergefell closely matched those who patiently worked for Roe's demise. The Southern Baptist network of mostly white evangelical churches, which has more than 12 million members and is aligned with the Republican Party, has long served as a base of support for the anti-abortion movement. Mr. Trump has shown no interest, however, in reversing Obergefell. As a candidate last year, he excoriated transgender rights and diversity programs, but not same-sex marriages, a choice that speaks to a political consensus that extends to some, if not all, of his MAGA base. Trump is reluctant to fully embrace the culture wars when politically it's unpopular, says Ms. Deckman. Mr. Kamenker agrees that Mr. Trump isn't an ally on this issue, and that the president seems more interested in courting LGBTQ+ donors, as he did in December 2022 at a celebration of gay rights held at Mar-a-Lago. The event was a gala for Log Cabin Republicans, a conservative LGBTQ+ group. "We are fighting for the gay community," Mr. Trump told the tuxedoed guests. "President Trump has been terrible on this issue," Mr. Kamenker says. So, this year, his organization took another tack, drafting resolutions for GOP state lawmakers who oppose same-sex marriage, non-binding resolutions calling for a reversal of Obergefell were introduced by lawmakers in state houses in Montana, Idaho, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Michigan, though none were passed or signed into law. Mr. Kamenker describes the resolutions as a way to show the Supreme Court how states feel about the issue. "They have some legitimacy," he says. In public hearings, mass resistance officials told lawmakers that states should reclaim their authority to restore the natural order of marriage and claimed that strong families had been eroded by the court's ruling. Around half of all states have constitutional or statutory bans or other limits on same-sex marriages. Should the Supreme Court end the federal right to marry, these laws would take effect, though these states would still be required to recognize same-sex couples who married in other states under the Respect for Marriage Act that President Joe Biden signed in 2022. Josh Shriver, a Republican lawmaker in Michigan, introduced an anti-Obergefell resolution in February that drew swift condemnation from Democratic lawmakers and from officials, including Attorney General Dana Nessel, the first LGBTQ plus person elected to a statewide position in Michigan. "I'm not giving up the fight to maintain marriage equality, and I'm not giving up this ring," Ms. Nessel said in a video posted on the social platform X, showing her ring finger. In a statement, Mr. Shriver described the 2015 Supreme Court ruling as a judicial imposition that disrupted the moral framework necessary for a stable and flourishing society. He said his resolution would restore order and end an aberration that wasn't a settled norm. "If we are serious about preserving the legacy of Western civilization, then restoring foundational institutions like marriage is essential," he told the Monitor. A legal showdown. Overturning Obergefell would require a constitutional case to be litigated and appealed before it could reach the Supreme Court. State resolutions that challenge rulings carry no legal weight. The court only addresses concrete disputes, not theoretical requests, says Daniel Pinello, a political scientist at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. One such case involves Kim Davis, a clerk in Kentucky, who refused to issue same-sex marriage licenses and was sued in 2015. A petition filed by Liberty Counsel, an evangelical law firm, seeks a review of her case, with the explicit goal of overruling Obergefell. The 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals recently denied a request to overturn a civil verdict against her. "Any legal showdown could be years away," says Mr. Kamenker, though he takes encouragement from Justice Thomas's Dobbs opinion and hopes that states will eventually regain authority over who is permitted to marry. "People shouldn't be forced to accept gay marriage," he says. He denies that the public has come to accept these unions. "What the Supreme Court has done," he says, "is force everyone else to accept this. Every business has to accept this. Every school has to teach that it's legitimate." He adds, "Homosexuality is naturally abhorrent to people, and it always has been." The Southern Poverty Law Center has described mass resistance as an anti-LGBTQ plus hate group. Mr. Kamenker says his group is a pro-family organization that advocates on many issues, not just same-sex marriage. Professor Pinello, who has written several books on and advocated for marriage equality, says he used to consider Obergefell the final word and to be settled law. The 2022 Dobbs decision changed his calculus. Though, as a federal right seen as inviolable, was taken away. Yet the reactions to the same ruling and to revelations about justices accepting gifts from wealthy donors also put some pressure on the court for restraint. "I think Obergefell is going to remain in place, if for no other reason than the Dobbs decision had a devastating impact on public opinion of the Supreme Court," he says. Next story. Q&A. Jim Obergefell reflects on the Supreme Court case that bears his name. By Cameron Pugh. 10 years ago, Thursday, the Supreme Court enshrined same-sex marriage as a constitutional right. Obergefell versus Hodges enabled LGBTQ plus couples to gain legal protections on a host of issues, from parenting and health care to taxes and rights of survivorship. Although his name is now synonymous with the push for marriage equality, Jim Obergefell, the lead plaintiff in the Hallmark case, never expected to become an activist. In 2011, Mr. Obergefell's late husband, John Arthur, was diagnosed with a terminal illness. The couple, who had been together for over 2 decades, married in Maryland 2 years later, but they soon realized that their home state of Ohio, which did not recognize same-sex unions, would not list Mr. Obergefell as Mr. Arthur's surviving spouse. That kicked off a campaign that would profoundly change the lives of LGBTQ plus Americans, who had long fought for, and in 36 states, won the right to wed. The couple sued Ohio that year, notching a win in district court before an appeals court reversed the decision. By the time the case reached the Supreme Court in fall of 2014, more than a dozen couples had joined the suit. Mr. Obergefell says he and Mr. Arthur fought not just for the right to call each other husband, but also for dignity for themselves and for the many other same-sex couples whose love the law did not recognize. John wanted to die a married man, Mr. Obergefell says in a phone interview with the Monitor, and I wanted the right to call myself his widower and have it mean exactly what it means to everyone else. Mr. Obergefell won that right in 2015, 2 years after Mr. Arthur died. When the court announced its decision, Mr. Obergefell said he hoped that the country would soon reach a day when gay marriage became known simply as marriage. Today, he celebrates the strides the United States has made toward that vision. A sizable majority, 68% of Americans, say same-sex marriages should be legal, according to polling from Gallup. Yet Mr. Obergefell and other LGBTQ plus people and activists worry that marriage equality remains on shaky ground. This year, some Republican lawmakers have introduced state legislation asking the Supreme Court to overturn its previous decision as flawed. In the following interview, which has been edited for length and clarity, Mr. Obergefell shares his views about the progress the country has made toward equality and what this polarized moment in U.S. politics might mean for the future of LGBTQ plus rights. What was it like to be at the center of such a historic and consequential Supreme Court case? Unexpected, overwhelming in some ways, but also just such a joy to be part of something that made a huge difference in our nation and, you know, had such a positive impact on so many people across the country. Boy, what a wonderful experience it was. How would you describe that experience? You know, it was really the chance to meet people across the country. As the case was going, people would recognize me, and they would come up to me and want to shake my hand, share a story, share photos, tell me about their loved one, about their spouse, about their partner, about their kid. It was a gift every single time it happened, and the fact that I had parents stop me and say, "Hey, Jim, could we take a photo of you with our child?" Because thanks to you and the other people in this case, we know our kid can marry the person they love, whomever that happens to be. I had closeted queer kids come out to me. They'd never come out to anyone before, but they came out to me. What is it like for you now to be reflecting on that case 10 years on? For me, it goes back to part of my comments in front of the Supreme Court after the decision. You know, I look forward to the day when this is not same-sex marriage or gay marriage, it's just marriage. And in so many ways, that has happened because people across the country, family members, neighbors, co-workers, they know someone who has married someone because of this decision. So it's become just marriage, and I love that. Honestly, it was a really easy decision. The most important person in my life, the person I love the most, was dying. And we had wanted to get married since the mid-90s. We had to do all of these things that millions of other people never had to think about or consider. Being forced to go to another state to get a marriage license. Figuring out how to take a dying man with no physical abilities to another state to do something, again, that millions of others took for granted. So we met this attorney, Al Gerhardstein, and he said, you know, you guys have a problem. When John dies, his last record as a person, his last records as an Ohioan will be wrong, because Ohio will completely ignore your lawful Maryland marriage on his death certificate. We just wanted to exist. John wanted to die a married man, and I wanted him to die a married man, and I wanted that right to call myself his widower and have it mean exactly what it means to anyone else. We wanted to use the word husband and have it mean what every other person in this country thinks of when they say the word husband. What was it like to not have those legal protections? Something can happen at any point. A car accident, and hospital staff could completely ignore the spouse, even though they have a lawful marriage in another state. They could ignore that spouse, prevent that spouse from seeing the person who is in medical distress, and they could absolutely refuse to take any direction from that lawful spouse. So that's just another issue that people don't think about. Same with a same-sex couple with kids. Well, if that state only allows one parent's name on that birth certificate, what happens if that parent dies? What happens to that kid? What happens to the relationship with the only other parent they've known? Marriage and the lawful recognition of marriage has such an impact on so many parts of our lives, but honestly, for John and me, it was all about dignity. In the latest Gallup poll, 68% of adults said they support gay marriage. What do you think of that shift? Well, it makes me happy. I can also say I'm not surprised. Because like anything, when there is a segment of society that a lot of people don't know, you know, they can't say, oh, I have friends or a family member who's queer, who is married, or I have a friend who happens to be transgender. When people can't say that, they create these images, these ideas of what people who are different are like, and those images are used in harmful ways because they're not accurate. And it's how entire communities of people are othered by people in the majority. So with same-sex marriage, it's become such a part of all of our communities, and the otherness of it has been diminished. So, yeah, it makes me happy. Do I wish the percentage who support marriage equality were higher? Of course, but I'll take every step in the right direction that we get in this country. Some Republican lawmakers and Supreme Court justices have openly signaled a desire to return to that ruling. I'm wondering what you think about that, as well as the recent Supreme Court decision regarding trans rights. You know, what it all comes down to, for me, is why? How did any queer marriage, or how does any queer marriage impact another person or another marriage? It doesn't. I just don't understand it. And, unfortunately, the trans community is bearing the brunt of so much of the hate that is out there in our nation. Attempts to ban life-saving, gender-affirming care. Bans on bathroom use, bans on trans kids playing sports. All of these things, they're not helping the nation. They're not making life better for anyone. All they're doing is making life significantly worse for the trans community and the people who love them, for their parents. I don't understand this need to other people, to demean people, to attack people because they happen to be different in a way that doesn't matter. We're all human beings. Do you have anything that you would say to the people who are trying to relitigate same-sex marriage? I would just remind them that, you know, in our nation's history, people fled the old world to come to the new world for religious freedom because they were persecuted in the old world for their religious beliefs. And that's what religious freedom in this country is supposed to be, where you can worship the way you want to in your home, in your place of worship. But you're not using your particular religious belief to persecute others. A few years ago, lawmakers with bipartisan support codified some protections for same-sex and interracial couples into law with the Respect for Marriage Act. Did that allay any of your concerns? Yes and no. I mean, I love that that act was passed into law, and the fact that it was bipartisan is a great thing. But if Obergefell is overturned, even with the Respect for Marriage Act in place, we no longer have marriage equality. The Respect for Marriage Act simply requires all states to recognize all marriages. But once again, people living in Ohio and other places could be denied a marriage license and the right to get married in the state they call home. That isn't marriage equality. What would you say to same-sex couples navigating the current climate? John and I were what I like to call quiet activists. We lived our lives openly. Every single person who met us, whether that was a neighbor, a stranger, a coworker, they knew we were a couple. We helped change hearts and minds, I think. I choose to believe we did because we were just ourselves. We were open and we helped break down some of those harmful preconceived notions. So be an activist in whatever way works for you. Be authentic. And make sure you vote, because voting is the only way we can ensure that our elected officials actually see every person in this country as part of we the people. And if we don't vote, we're allowing other people to determine our worth, our value, our rights as a human being. And finally, from the Monitor's view, a light of dignity in New York's Central Park. A new community sports and outdoor complex, including a pool, opens in a once neglected corner of the park, reclaiming a civic belonging and recognition for nearby neighborhoods. By the Monitor's editorial board. Early in this first sweltering week of summer, the weather station in New York's famed Central Park recorded the city's highest temperatures in more than a decade. Now, at week's end, this 843-acre oasis in Manhattan marks a high point of a different sort. On Friday, the park's recently completed $160 million Davis Center opens an immense, newly refurbished swimming pool to the public. The facility's soaring pavilion, lush landscaping, and inviting waters restore both beauty and accessibility to a formerly neglected and crumbling section of Central Park. The remodeled environment and infrastructure also symbolize a rebuilding of civic inclusion and trust with residents in adjacent Harlem and East Harlem. From the mid-1970s through the 1990s, when New York City struggled to recover from near bankruptcy, this northeast corner of Central Park became synonymous with urban decay and delinquency. Perceptions of neighborhoods that were predominantly black or Hispanic conflated poverty and criminality. In 1989, a horrific sexual assault of a woman jogger resulted in the wrongful conviction of 5 black and Hispanic teenagers from Harlem. They were exonerated in 2002 and released, but a deep sense of hurt and suspicion lingered within their community. When the nonprofit Central Park Conservancy launched the restoration after the pandemic, there was a lot of learning about the residual anger and disaffection, according to its president, Betsy Smith. But conversations with community representatives showed there are a lot of people who care about integrating this community into the park, she's told Bloomberg News. Prominent among them is Yusef Salam, one of the wrongfully arrested teens. After his release, Mr. Salam had written a memoir, Better, Not Bitter. He married and built a family, and in 2023, he was elected to the city council. Speaking at the April launch of the pavilion, Mr. Salam acknowledged the stunning architectural accomplishment of the complex. Both the pool and the building are multi-use, multi-season marvels of design and engineering. The pool converts to an artificial turf-topped field in spring and fall, and to a skating rink in winter. The building has a half-acre green roof and floor-to-ceiling glass doors that pivot to let in summer breezes or keep out cold air. But to Mr. Salam, the facility is about much more than recreation. It's a homecoming, a healing for me, he said, according to the West Side Spirit. It's a restoration for our community, not only our land, but our dignity as well. The shadow of injustice loomed large here. Today, we reclaim that light, he declared. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, June 26th, 2025, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Greg Riddell. Thanks for listening. Good night.